This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, back live. Every year, millions of young adults start college and find it can be a daunting experience. For many of them, it's their first time living on their own, away from home, while dealing with challenging classes and other stresses of those new experiences. All of that can be even more tricky if you're a student who is neurodivergent. That is, someone whose brain works differently from what our society considers typical. The term encompasses a wide range of attributes and conditions, from ADHD and autism to dyslexia and Tourette syndrome. The rise in prominence of this idea of neurodivergence is just one part of a broader cultural shift in how we think about those conditions. Rather than something to be treated or cured, growing movements advocate for the acceptance of these characteristics as a natural variation of the human species. Part of that means having support systems in place for the people who would benefit from them, while also acknowledging that there's no one-size-fits-all approach, because, obviously, different people have different needs. To talk about what this can look like in practice, we're joined now by Dr. Jeannie Kramer. She's director of the Autism Program, known for short as TAP, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's also currently leading the Illinois Neurodiversity Initiative, a program for neurodivergent students on that campus. It's wrapping up its first year. Jeannie, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Taylor Sweeting. He's an autism self-advocate, a disability self-advocate, and he's based in Springfield. Taylor, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Zoe Gross, Director of Advocacy for the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, a nonprofit organization based out of Washington, D.C. It's run by and for people on the autism spectrum, and it advocates for the inclusion of autistic people in all aspects of life. Zoe, thank you for being here as well.
Good to be here.
And listeners, our phone lines are open to take your calls at 800-222-9455. What do you want to know about neurodivergence? Or maybe you are someone who's neurodivergent. How did that affect, or how maybe is it affecting your college experience? And how do you advocate for yourself in your daily life? 800-222-9455 is the number to call. We'll be talking about this for the rest of our program today. 800-222-9455. All right, Taylor, I want to begin with you. I offered that quick sort of catch-all definition of neurodivergence, but what does neurodivergence mean to you?
So for me, neurodivergence is a part of my identity. I was diagnosed with autism when I was 3 years old, and I never really understood what autism was. I just knew that that was something that made me different than my peers. So I really sort of had a disdain for it in the beginning. But when I turned 12 years old, I was given this concept that I don't see the world the same as everybody else. And that's why I see things and I do things so differently. And ever since then, I feel like that's just become a huge aspect of my life, is I want to try and communicate how I view the world, because you're exactly right. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. And I feel like I wake up every day autistic. I don't understand what it's like to not see the world through that lens. And so I feel like it's important not just to voice what that experience is, but to, I think, really bring some pride and bring excellence to the concept that it is a part of my life, and what I can do and what others who are neurodivergent as well, what they can bring to the table to our community and ultimately to our society and culture as a whole.
Zoe, I want to ask you that same question about what neurodivergence means to you.
So neurodivergence, that is disabilities that are in the brain, so like autism or other learning disabilities, intellectual disabilities. To me, that's just a natural part of human diversity, and I feel like the fact that we have different types of brains should be celebrated, like the fact that we have different genders or sexual orientations. That's not to say that life with a disability is always sunshine and rainbows. Obviously, living with a disability is difficult sometimes. But having a disability is an identity that you can be proud of, as Taylor said.
And Jeannie, maybe you can talk about, I think if we go back, I don't know, even 5 years, 10 years, certainly, the conversations about this, the word neurodivergent was still gaining ground. And I guess it still is to this day. You would hear more often, though, terms like on the spectrum. Can you just talk about how and why people have embraced that word neurodivergent?
Well, I think that comes from a better understanding of what's going on as far as the world of autism goes. It did originate in individuals who are on the autism spectrum. And for such a long period of time, you're talking 5, 10, 15 years ago, people were trying to find a cure for autism. People were treating autism as if it was, as if you could find a genetic link or you could find something that was wrong inside the person. And after years and years and years of research, we have not been able to identify one single thing that quote-unquote causes autism. I like the word natural variance of the brain. The brain is, all of our brains are different. And I happen to think that this lower support need segment of people who are on the autism spectrum, they are the people whose brains are going to solve some of the world's biggest problems. So, there are forms of autism that are much more severe. And like our other guest said, maybe we don't want to celebrate the individuals on the spectrum who are really, really struggling. It can be a huge hardship. But when we do embrace those...
I didn't say that.
You were saying that having a disability is difficult. And
Of course it is. But I think that people with high support needs deserve to be celebrated just as much.
But not their difficulties. The people, absolutely. But not their difficulties. And I think that's what I'm referring to. Please don't get me wrong. I support the concept of neurodivergence completely and to its fullest capacity. But the difficulties that people on the spectrum can experience can affect themselves physically, emotionally, can affect families. And those things are things that we need to work together as a society to help to, and I don't celebrate those things, but I do celebrate the accomplishments, the wonderful brains of the people who are on the spectrum and who were created the way that they are so that they can see the world differently and solve the world's problems.
And I think there's a lot of that we're going to unpack as we go on in this conversation. Let me just take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about neurodivergence, particularly in the college experience, in the context of there's a program at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign called the Illinois Neurodiversity Initiative, which is meant to welcome neurodivergent students on campus and help them find their best college experience. We're also talking about this with Zoe Gross, who's Director of Advocacy for the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and Taylor Sweeting, who's an Autism Self-Advocate and a Disability Self-Advocate based in Springfield, Illinois. I also want to bring another voice into the conversation now, and this is in the context that these neurodivergent conditions or attributes, if you will, can often be diagnosed early in life, but that's not the case for everybody. And Zoe, I'm going to ask you about that, but first I do want to bring in this voice of a University of Illinois student. Obviously, it can be difficult to get them to join us in the middle of a day. They have classes and that sort of thing. But last week, one of our show's producers, Christine Hatfield, spoke with Avi, who is a junior at U of I Urbana-Champaign majoring in psychology. Avi is also president and co-founder of the student organization Actually Neurodivergent. And Avi talked about his experience realizing he was autistic at the age of 19. Let's listen.
A lot of it for me had been going through my life not really knowing why I felt different from everyone around me, just knowing that there was something about me that was fundamentally different. And when I finally, a lot of the ideas of what we have about autism portrayed are a pretty limited view. And when I started learning more about what autism actually is from autistic people, it really resonated with me. It was like a I described it as like getting a new pair of glasses where I can see everything so much more clearly. It just made everything make so much sense in my life.
Zoe, how common are experiences like that?
It's very common among autistic people to learn you're autistic later in life. For some people, this happens when they go into an environment that's more challenging and sort of overwhelms their capacities and makes their disability more apparent to them, like going to college. For some people, it even happens when they have children and the children are diagnosed as autistic because there's a strong hereditary component to autism. So that leads to questions about whether there is autism in the child's family. People who are assigned female at birth and people of color are less likely to get diagnoses as young children than people who are assigned male at birth and white children are. So there are also disparities in diagnosis at a young age that can lead to delayed diagnosis for people in marginalized groups.
And I want to get to the neurodiversity initiative in a minute, but Taylor, what challenges did you face as a neurodivergent college student?
I would say one of my bigger challenges was I'm a very routine-based person, and I really depend on a routine to kind of get me through the day and to get me through my time. And I had this poster, you know, image in my head of, okay, so I'm going to be in college. I'm going to go to this class. I'm going to work on this assignment. I'm going to go to dinner. I'm going to do some more homework. I'm going to go to bed. I had this all planned out. And as most people who have had a dorm experience, you know, can attest, that's not always the case, right? You end up, you know, meeting up with friends or people come over or, you know, there's things going on in your dorm and activities across campus. So that was a huge thing for me. But I think also just gaining more understanding of myself and learning to advocate for myself, which was a huge, huge thing. I really feel like a big part of my time in college was learning not just about, you know, the subject matter of, I went to school to attain my bachelor's in social work. So I feel like in a way I was kind of getting this socialization kind of education, you know, along with going to college and going through the college experience. But it really, I think, opened the door to the idea of what it is to advocate not just for myself, but for other people. Because again, there is no one-size-fits-all solution, and the needs that I had would maybe differ from the needs of another neurodivergent student or another situation. And so you find yourself having to do a lot of self-reflection, self-exploration. So I think that those two aspects were probably, if I had to say, were the difficult aspects of my college experience, those would be it.
Well, Dr. Jeannie Kramer, I think that's a good segue then into asking you about what exactly is, big picture, what is the Neurodiversity Initiative?
We began several years ago working with Microsoft, who's one of Illinois' one of their main pipelines of talent. They came to the university with an initiative to create a pipeline of autistic talent to Microsoft. And we began at that time piloting programming for autistic students. COVID hit kind of when we were getting into the groove of things. And last year, we were finally able to roll out what we had been working on, what we had been investigating up until that time. So everyone who's on the spectrum is different, but we have identified different areas in students on the spectrum that should be looked out for. One is mental health. So part of our programming is to provide weekly mental health check-ins for the students, keeping just a finger on the pulse of their mental health as they travel through university. Another component is executive function, which is the way our brain organizes and uses time and information to demonstrate our intelligence. Very early on, the students participate in a class that's open to the entire university, but to only neurodivergent students. And that class uses coursework from other core classes to practice strategies that help with things like studying, managing stress as it comes to academics, learning new material, organizing time. Another area that we concentrate on is social connectedness. We want to provide these students with community, with others who are like them and can identify with some of the day-to-day things that they go through. But we also want to help them get plugged in to places in the university where they can find other students who have similar interests with them and who can be a base or a source of friendships at the university. And the last component that we want to identify right from the time the student arrives on campus is employment readiness. We are in active conversations with many corporations across the country who are interested in hiring autistic talent. The workforce has realized that people on the spectrum, though they are all vastly different, oftentimes can focus very deeply and intently on something that their brain finds interesting and be up to 80% more productive than their coworkers around them. People on the spectrum tend to take away the social judgment when it comes to decision making and can provide very clear and different perspectives to solving problems. Mm-hmm. So we like to connect them with employers and get them ready for the workforce starting their freshman year.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation when we come back. We're talking about neurodiversity and the college experience, be it ADHD or autism or any number of other traits or conditions that can fall under that umbrella. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation. We have at least one caller on the line. Stay with us. We will get to you as soon as we get back. Again, 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about neurodivergence, the idea of someone's brain working differently from what our society might consider the norm. And we're talking about the different ways that can manifest, how the way we look at neurodivergence and the conditions often associated with it has changed, and the support systems in place to help those people succeed in life, and in particular today in our conversation, in college. We're talking about this with Dr. Jeannie Kramer, who leads the Illinois Neurodiversity Initiative, a program for neurodivergent students on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus that's wrapping up its first year. Also with us is Illinois autism self-advocate Taylor Sweeting and Zoe Gross, who's director of advocacy for the national organization called the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. You can join us at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm going to take a call in just a second, but Zoe, I want to ask you first about this idea of intersectionality, as it's known. And to do that, I want to bring in Avi Hessel again, the U of I junior who runs the student organization, Actually Neurodivergent. As I mentioned earlier, they couldn't join us live, but they spoke last week with one of our producers, Christine Hatfield. This is what Avi had to say about the importance of neurodivergent people speaking for themselves.
Neurodivergent people who are going every day and experiencing ableism can tell you much better about what needs to change than a neurotypical person who has not experienced that themselves. And it's also important because neurodivergent people who experience an intersection of oppression alongside ableism, like racism, transphobia, sexism, etc., can have an input so that changes that are made don't only benefit the dominant majority that is often featured.
Zoe, can you say more about that? How are these different fights, right? Racial equality, disability rights, trans rights, how are they intertwined?
Sure. So there's a lot of ways that different fights against oppression are connected. One thing that comes immediately to mind that we're dealing with right now is across the country, there's a wave of anti-trans legislation trying to target gender-affirming healthcare and keep trans people, especially trans youth, from getting the healthcare that they need to live as the gender that they are. And one of the things that the people championing this hateful legislation will do is they'll say, well, trans people are often autistic. There's an overlap between those two communities, and autistic people don't understand things like gender, and so they can't really be transgender. And so because trans people are often autistic, we shouldn't make this healthcare available. And obviously that's really hateful both to transgender people and to autistic people, saying that we don't understand our own bodies and we don't understand our own genders and we can't understand what kind of healthcare we need. So an autistic transgender person shouldn't be allowed to access healthcare. That's incredibly hateful and damaging. But that's just one way that, an example of the ways that oppressions are connected, and people will use one kind of oppression to further another.
All right, I think this is a good time to bring in a caller on line four. Lynn is calling from Macon County. Lynn, thank you for being patient, and thanks for calling in.
Sure. Are you able to hear me?
I am. Please go ahead with your question.
Questions for, really, for Dr. Jeannie there. I guess 35 years in the field of special education, and careful that we don't conflate issues today, but what's really important is that for the last 20 years or so, it's been noted in leader states in services for autism, Minnesota, Oregon, Hawaii, that there is a lack of screening that is related to class, well, sociodemographics in general. And you can find these articles in the National Institutes of Health Research and the Journal Medical Association. So this research is out there. And we know that there are antitrust lawsuits happening in different parts of the country around the BCBA empire, the idea of applied behavioral analysis for K-12. And I sure know that Dr. Kramer's show today is about University of Illinois, and that's awesome. And I just wonder if she has anything to say about why Illinois has lagged so far behind in screenings that in Minnesota, Oregon, Hawaii, have been happening for over 20 years to make sure that our children that are lower income or perhaps, as the previous speaker said, have racial oppressions, other oppressions, that they're served with those pre-assessment special ed services. Illinois is one of the states that ProPublica featured for having the isolation rooms, the solitary confinement rooms. Mm-hmm. So while it's really awesome that Microsoft is pipelining people at the college age into jobs that require, their ability to take away social judgment. At the other end of it, we have children still today languishing without proper sensory screenings that could be delivered by school personnel. And there are, as I say, business model reasons for why special education co-ops, while they're funded to do so, aren't doing it. That's a lot. That's another show. But I'll take my answer off air. I just wondered if Dr. Kramer had anything to say about racial disparities and autism screening.
All right, Lynn, that a lot there to digest, but thank you for the call. We really appreciate it. And Dr. Jeannie Kramer, I wonder if you have a perspective on that, sort of the lack maybe of early screening in Illinois.
Yeah, I do have to say that I am not an expert in public policy. I do know that the state of Illinois is one of the most frustrating states to work in when you are trying to provide wraparound services for autistic individuals. I was at a lecture last week with Linda Tortorelli, who is an area specialist in autism and in public policy. She has a lot more to say about this and the history behind why the state of Illinois is not where it needs to be as far as community-based services go. But there are decisions that were made as to where funding was going to go several years ago that has affected our ability to provide services at the community level that are needed. And again, that's another topic for another show, but that's about as much as I feel comfortable saying, not being an expert in the area.
Fair enough. I want to get into one other aspect of this that, we haven't talked quite as much about yet. And Taylor, I think I'm going to ask you this. We had another clip of Avi Hessel, but for the sake of time, I'm just going to kind of summarize it, which is this idea of pathologizing neurodivergence, right? That this is something to be treated, something to be cured potentially. Taylor, can you just talk about what maybe problems you see with that line of thinking?
Absolutely. So there's nothing that's more demeaning than when you're being talked about in a large group or in a meeting or with, you know, the experts talking about, you know, what can we do to treat your condition? What can we do to, you know, do something to create an ease of autism? And I, more than anybody, understand the difficulties that autism can have as well. So I agree, autism's not all rainbows and sunshine, but I do not need to be cured. Autism does not need to be cured. And I think there is this fundamental concept that, you know, we want to try and eradicate or at least bring, you know, this severity of autism to, you know, bring it down. And for me, as an autism self-advocate and working with other autistic individuals and neurodivergent individuals, I just find that rhetoric so demeaning. And there's, I subscribe to the concept of nothing about us without us. I may not be an expert in autism, but I am an expert on my autism. And therefore, I am the greatest advocate for myself. And as part of my advocacy, I do presentations on the national level. I've gone to other states talking about autism and doing presentations and lectures. And the main thing that I tell people is when it comes to being an advocate, you need to talk to those who have autism. We will be the ones to understand it the most. I was born with autism. I will die with autism. I've had it for 35 years, and for as long as I live is how long I'll have it. So for me, I am the expert on my autism. And if my understanding and my advocacy can help other people learn to accept and to understand their autism, that's the whole goal. But no, I agree. There is a detrimental concept that autism needs to be lessened or that there's treatment options. And I find that rhetoric to be very, very demeaning and very sad that people want to find a cause to why I am the way I am. And there's a potential cure out there for that, because that brings down the concept of my character and who I am. As I said before, autism is a part of my identity. And when people immediately paint that in a negative view, that's that not, there's very few things in this world that really, I think, demean me more than that.
Well, thank you for sharing your perspective and experience on that. I do appreciate it. I want to see if we can get one more caller in here. Julianne is calling from Palatine on line 4. Julianne, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Kramer. I'm just wondering if there's a difference between the diagnosis age of autism with girls and boys. Do they get diagnosed at different ages usually?
All right. Thank you for that question.
That's a really good question and very worth discussing at this point. People who are assigned female at birth absolutely are diagnosed at a later age, despite the fact that parents will bring these individuals who are assigned female at birth to the doctor at the same age of concern. So a 3-year-old little boy, 3-year-old little girl, both brought to the doctor, something's different about my child. And the boy will go on for a diagnosis, and the girl may be assigned many other different mental health conditions that are inaccurate when autism is at the root of it. So we find many more individuals who are assigned female at birth getting diagnosed in their late teens, early adulthood, than we do those who are assigned assigned male at birth.
I think as we are running out of time on our program today, Zoe, I want to give you the last word. Programs like the Neurodiversity Initiative we were talking about are just one part of the bigger picture of the sort of things that would help neurodivergent students succeed in college and in life. What other steps that maybe aren't present now should we be doing?
Sure. I think there's a lot of different approaches to this. One is to talk about accommodations. So, part of the benefit that programs like the autism program give is to help students get and advocate for accommodations. And accommodations are changes to like a workplace or school policy or environment or things like deadlines or other kinds of adjustments that can help a disabled person succeed in their school or workplace. And that's something that is really important to the success of autistic people and people with other disabilities is getting accommodations. I think another thing is self-advocacy, and those are really connected. It's difficult to get accommodations in college and beyond if you don't, if you aren't able to sort of advocate for yourself why you need those. And it's a real turning point in college because that's when advocating for accommodations becomes your responsibility as opposed to in high school where there's a team of specialists and your parents are also involved. But from college and beyond, it's sort of on you to get your own accommodations. So self-advocacy skills become really important. And it's important that people are trained in self-advocacy for a young age and know how to talk about their disability and how it affects them and what they need because of that without shame and without hesitation. And just as a matter of fact, say, this is who I am and this is the accommodations that I need and here's what I can do.
Zoe Gross is Director of Advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. We've also been speaking with Taylor Sweeting, who is an autism self-advocate, and Dr. Jeannie Kramer, Director of the Autism Program at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much to all of you for being with us today on The 21st Show. We very much appreciate your time. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. We'll talk about an exhibit of violins that were played by Jewish people before and during the Holocaust. Plus, the annual Ebertfest Film Festival is this week in Champaign-Urbana, and we'll have a preview with co-founder Chaz Ebert. That's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. Remember, the Founding Fathers said no taxation without representation, and the modern version of that is nothing about us without us. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.